said to her preacher in the presence of her new husband, said, no, the Bible says that no good thing the Lord withhold of those that love Him. She said, my husband's one of those no good things. I know what she meant, even if it didn't come out the way she wanted. I can certainly empathize with that. Somebody said marriage is a gamble. Says that he begins by showing a diamond, and she shows a heart. Her husband, or rather her father, has a club. His father has a spade. And somewhere around there, there's a joker lurking, but pretty soon he becomes the king, and she becomes the queen, and eventually together they have a full house. Well, in an age in which Gary Collins, and maybe this is a little dated statistic, says the average marriage lasts 9.4 years. You and I know those who have overshot that and undershot that in a significant way. There is a couple in North Carolina who just had their marriage entered into the Guinness Book of World Records. Their last name is Fisher. They've been married 86 years. Now, it helps that both of them have to live to be over 100 years old, but they were dedicated. And they mentioned that the very things that kept them together were their faith and their friends and their family, and having those as their emphases. On the other end of the scale, I read a couple of years ago, I believe now it was about 7 years ago this week, that Frank W. Shope II, and Lori Ann Spangler of Mill Hall, Pennsylvania, both of them about 34 years old, decided to get married. They had the marriage just after noon, and they had the reception at a local bar where they both began to drink heavily and began to argue incessantly. And the fight escalated until just after midnight on April 27th, 2003. When agitated and angry, Frank W. Shope took a gun and killed his new bride and then took his own life. I couldn't help but think as I read that little cold short story in a newspaper that 12 hours before that they had to look into each other's eyes with at least some hope and to some level of admiration for one another. And it ended so quickly, so brutally. I do believe whatever we call these series, and certainly not because I'm the one up here speaking, because I'm far too aware of my own frailties and failures, that this subject is something we cannot overly emphasize. Wherever you're preaching, you are having families in that midst who are struggling. You may not know it. They come in and they sit on a pew on Sunday morning or even Sunday night and Wednesday night, and as they sit there, they look around the auditorium and they see somebody. It may be the preacher and his wife, or it may be the elder and his wife, and they look at them and they think, boy, I wish mine was like that. They don't have any problems. They look so good together. They're so happy together. Look how loving and affectionate they are, not knowing what's going on behind their doors, but stuck in their dissatisfaction. And they look at their own child rearing and they say, boy, I wish things were different than they are. Well, today we're going to look at the subject of rearing children to love the Lord. Fathers sometimes get an unfair shake. There was the doting dad of two small children, and that dad would always pray with his children before, or rather sing to them before bedtime. Until he heard the 4-year-old saying to the 2-year-old, act like you're asleep and he'll stop. There was the dad who came in one evening and sat down, and before he read the evening newspaper, he said to his son, he said, would you like me to help you with your homework tonight, son? To which his son replied, that's all right, Dad. I think I can get it wrong all by myself tonight. Would you say that in our society that dads have been marginalized and minimized? The attitude that society has toward fathers is one as who is to be looked at condescendingly. One who's a joke and a farce. I don't recommend much that's on television anymore, and I'm not current because I can't think of a single television show that's on right now that we follow. But I've seen enough in time to see that over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years that the father figure was a joke. He was the dumbest guy in the house. Anybody, the smallest of his children, were always smarter and wiser than he was. And we think about the feminist movement. They believe and would like to believe that fathers are obsolete and that they certainly should not be a viable participant in the family process at all. But I also think about some dads who have withdrawn themselves from the family process. Fathers who have not been engaged. Fathers who have neglected, have abandoned their children. You know, it's a growing specter in society across every ethnic and eco-socionomical factor that you can measure. Fathers are getting scarcer and scarcer. And the fathers that are there are struggling with whether or not they are prioritizing their home. My question is the preacher exempt from the possibility of being a poor parent or of neglecting his duty? Perhaps there is no question that I ask myself with more self-criticism or concern more frequently than that question. You know, there's very little information about preacher's kids in the New Testament. And what we do have there is only implied. Wouldn't you like it if there was a section of Scripture, a pericope you could go to that showed this family, this preacher and his wife and their children and what he did and what the Bible outlines specifically for preacher's children? For those PKs? It can be inferred that Peter not only had children, but that he had children that loved the Lord. Because Peter was an elder, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 1 and following. And we know certain things about a man who would serve as an elder. He is one who has to have his children and his household in subjection, and he must rule them well, and they need to be believing children. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, and Titus chapter 1 and verse 6. But Paul was single. And what do we know about the home lives of the other apostles outside of the fact that many of them, as we said yesterday, were married and carried about a wife? What about their children? Now what we do know is that as we go to the Old Testament and we begin to do a survey of God's full-time workers under the Old Testament, the priests, but boy, they had some dysfunction from time to time. You think about Aaron's boys and the disrespect and dishonor that they showed to God as treating the holy as the profane in Leviticus 10, 1-3, and keep reading down in Leviticus chapter 10, some would argue that God could have repeated the process with two more of Eli's children because of their not handling their functions as the priest as they ought to. What about Eli's boys, Hophni and Phinehas? They were rebellious. They were treacherous. They were terrors, 1 Samuel chapter 2. And Samuel's boys, Joel and Abijah, they weren't much better than that. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2 through 4. So where do we go to get solid guidelines for how we are to be fathers and mothers of preachers' children? You know, Kathy and I have tried to live by a principle that I'm sure we learned not only in our own homes, but when we went to school. We've tried to follow a very simple and a very basic philosophy. Our boys are expected to do certain things, and they are expected to avoid certain things because they are being raised in a Christian home. See, that's going to be the governance. And Gary and Dale and Carl are all now Christians, and they're expected to do certain things that God commands all Christians to do. And it's only incidental that they're being raised in a home where their father is a preacher and their mother is the preacher's wife. There should be no higher goal for us as a family than to rear children who love the Lord. And to that end, we are talking about the preacher's family, and I want to primarily focus on the preacher. Now, I realize that some of the things I'm going to have to say are things that are certainly applicable more broadly than that to all Christian men, and I hope that there is application here this morning that can be used by Christian women too. But if mothers set the emotional tone of the home, then fathers set its spiritual direction. I challenge you to look through your New Testament and find a single admonition on parenting that is addressed to mothers first. But I will show you 19 admonitions that begins with an address that God has by way of leadership. I know about Titus chapter 2, but I'm talking about leadership. It's addressed to the father almost 20 times. So God's saying that the mantle of leadership falls first and heaviest
on us as fathers. Charlie Shedd wrote 40 books. He was said to be the originator of the Christian weight loss movement. He wrote a regular syndicated column. He was a favorite of radio and television personalities. He was one of Paul Harvey's favorites. But what he was known for the most was his advice on parenting, on marriage, and on relationships. And some years ago, Charlie Shedd sat down with quite a few children, and he asked them about expectations that they had. What did they think made for a good dad? And here's some of what they said. He takes time for me. He listens to me. He plays with me. He lets me help. He treats my mother well. He lets me say what I think. He is nice to my friends. He punishes me only when I deserve it. And he's not afraid to admit when he's wrong. If we were to sit down and to survey wives as to what they thought made for a good husband, there are several factors that might come to bear. The things like communication and understanding and tenderness, emotional investment, honesty, stability, tenderness, romance, confidence in her abilities, a cool ringtone, adoration, spontaneity, and independence. If you ask a man what he thinks makes for a good home, he's going to say some different things. He's going to say, I have a status and a position in this world that my family can be proud of. That I am a good provider for my home. That I have a name of which my family can be very proud. I'm not saying that any of those things are inherently wrong, but men, have we sometimes worked on our list to the neglect of our wife and our children's list and what they think makes for a good leader in the home? How many times have men sat down, their homes on the brink of ruin, tears streaming down their cheeks and their words coated with desperation? Here they were just a relatively few years short of the grave. And they had a name as being a public success, but their home was in domestic shambles. I want to share with you the words of a man who was a public success, whose home was in shambles. Have mercy upon me, O God, according unto thy loving kindness, according unto the multitudes of thy tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquities, and cleanse me from my sins. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned, and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden parts thou shalt make me to know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones that thou hast broken may rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, and blot out all my transgressions. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from thy presence, O God, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and uphold me with thy free spirit. David was a man who was a national hero. 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 50. He was a military hero. Remember what they said? Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his tens of thousands. 1 Samuel 18 and verse 17. And he was a spiritual hero. Of David it said in 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14 that he is a man after God's own heart. And it's repeated in the New Testament looking back. No less than Stephen said it. He was a man who was considered a man of secular achievement. He was a man of social balance. He was a man of spiritual devotion. And then a tragic twist of events occurred. prompted by idleness, 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, and lust, 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 2, and covetousness, 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 3. David called for, brought up to his room, and committed adultery with Bathsheba, 2 Samuel 12, 11 rather, in verse 4. And then he was guilty of deception, verse 6 through verse 13. He was guilty then of conspiracy and murder in verse 15, and he was guilty of theft in verse 27. He had a child out of wedlock with another man's wife, causing even the enemies of God to blaspheme. 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 1. David made wrong choices, but he created wounds in his home from which his family would never recover. Almost a year goes by. Perhaps David thinks that he's gotten away with it. Nathan comes to him and confronts him and says, "Nevertheless, the sword of the Lord shall never depart from your home because you have despised me and have taken as your wife Uriah the Hittite's wife." And then we began to read the roll call. David himself had set the sentence earlier as the parable was brought to him by Nathan that he would restore fourfold, and David did. There was that little child conceived as he was in that illegitimate relationship that died. And then you remember that his son, Amnon, raped his daughter Tamar, his sister Tamar, David's daughter Tamar. 2 Samuel 13 and verse 1. In retaliation for that, Absalom killed his brother, David's son, Amnon. 2 Samuel 13 and verse 32. Later on, Absalom tries to take away the throne from his father David. And in the course of that, one of David's brutal soldiers took his life, 2 Samuel 18 and verse 14. And when the news got to David, he was much troubled in the spirit. And he went to his chamber over the gate, and as he went, thus he cried, "O Absalom, my son Absalom, would to God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son." And then David is at the end of his life, and Abijah wants the throne, and Solomon takes his life. 1 Kings 2 and verse 24. If a man who is remembered as one of God's great heroes, as a man after God's own heart, who was such a national success, could fail in his home life, as a preacher of the gospel, can I think of myself as immune from the kinds of things that can leave a bad legacy in my home? And thus I want us to focus on what a preacher should leave his family. And the bottom line of that is he needs to leave children that love the Lord. But I want to examine that a little closer this morning in the time that we have left, in a few minutes. Number one, the preacher should leave his family a name that is untarnished. Solomon lauds the importance of a good name. He says a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of one's death than the day of one's birth. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 1. You know, names are important to us. I know you probably heard about the secretary that received a phone call from an anonymous man, and as she took the phone call, he said, "Yes, ma'am, I'd like to speak to the head hog at the trough." She said, "Sir?" "Yeah, I'd like to speak to the head hog at the trough." She said, "If you're talking about our preacher, you can call him preacher, you can call him minister or evangelism, but please don't refer to him as the head hog at the trough." He said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I just wanted to speak to somebody about donating $150,000 to your building fund." About that time, the door rattled. And she said, "Wait a minute, I think I hear the big pig now." Names are important. They matter, don't they? Names are important to us. I think about our oldest son. His name is Gary Neal III. He's named for me, and I'm named for my dad. Our middle son, James Dale. James, Kathy's dad. Dale, Kathy's granddad, was born on his granddad's birthday. And then Carl Mitchell. Mitchell is my mom's maiden name, and her dad was one of the finest elders I've ever known. And all the grandchildren, male grandchildren, have a middle name, Mitchell. Why do we do that kind of thing? Because names are important to us. You would not name your son, I don't think, Osama bin Laden Jones. You wouldn't call him Madeline Murray Miller. Why? Because names are important. Names are important to God too. God often named or renamed those in the Old Testament and the New Testament. The name that we see in Isaiah 62 and verse 2, that there was going to be a name, a new and glorious name, which the people of God were going to be called. And we fast forward over 700 years and we get to the first century and we see that model church that was racially diverse, that had a mission-minded spirit, that were evangelistic, that were growing in the grace of the Lord, and that were full of the grace of God. It was evident to Barnabas. And the disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. Now, we carry around a name. You have a surname. And I hope you're proud of it. You should be. Because you can make of that name whatever you want. And you can leave a name for your children and your family that they can be proud of. But it's only the second most important name that you're going to have. The most important name that you wear is the name of Christ. And as a preacher, you can never forget that. You need to leave your family a name that they can be proud of, a name untarnished. Their name should not be tarnished with debt. Certainly all families struggle with hardship, but fathers will not be compulsive and will not be irresponsible. To protect our family's name, we're going to live by the motto, "Owe no man anything," Romans 13 and verse 8. He's the steward of the family's name as well as its finances, and so he's going to be faithful. 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 2. Credit card debt, excessive installment debt, and optional expenses that strain the family budget can quickly tarnish the family name. But also he's going to leave his family a name that is not tarnished by indiscretion. There's some material that maybe we'll have at another time to share. Brother Wendell Winkler had a section that he did in Preacher in His Work called The Deadly D's. And there was several of them, and it was debt, and there were several other things. One of them was discretionlessness. Now, it was alliterated, so he had to have it with a D. Indiscretion would be another way to say that. But what's he saying? You know, he would say to us, if a woman is indiscreet with you the first time, never let there be a second time. She comes up to you on the sly, on the side, and says something to you that you would be very uncomfortable to hear if your wife was around. What do? Stay away from that woman. Don't be alone with her. Pull the blinds up. Open the doors. Have somebody there if you're counseling. Avoid indiscretion. Because you can quickly tarnish the family name if you all have a vigilant attitude. Somebody says, well, nobody's going to think a thing about that. Well, you'd better think about it. Because David's indiscretion began, it would seem, most innocently, but very quickly turned from that. God keeps such records of our speech that every idle word is recorded. Matthew 12, 36 and 37. He has his eye on everything that a man intends to do in secret. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 12. God has privy to every thought that a man thinks. Every minute that a man spends. Every dollar that a man spends. Every motive whereby a man is moved. And every desire whereby a man is spurred. Hebrews 4 and verse 13 says, neither is there any creature that is not manifest in his sight, but all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. That age-old, very simple principle is I carry Christ with me where I go, whatever I do, will help me to protect my family's name from indiscretion. May we as fathers hear Solomon, that discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee. But men, we also need to give our family a name that is not tarnished by strife. Fathers need to have a long wick with a slow burner. We need to have two turnable cheeks. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 39. The world is watching how we deal with our fellow man. You know, one of the things that we can do to undermine our influence is to not be the same guy at the gas station and at Walmart or in the restaurant that we are when we get up and we preach. I say that that's something we struggle with because I've been at restaurants and groups of preachers where they did not think about the fact that that waitress was a person with a soul. But in whatever they were caught up in, they condescended toward her. We've got to be very careful about that. How do we treat one another? It reflects on our family's name. Do we start trouble or do we stop trouble? A wrathful man stirs up strife, but he that is slow to anger appeases strife. Proverbs 15 and verse 18. The world is watching how we treat our spiritual family, and so are our children. How are those car conversations on the way home from church? Are you sharing the agitation that you feel toward the elders or toward some problem member? You may be justified, but do you really want to do that in front of your children? Is that the collective memory you want them to have of the church through your eyes as they grow up in your home? Or is it of how much you love brother or sister so-and-so? And how you appreciated something that you saw them do. That's not manipulative. It's a matter of adjusting your attitude and seeing the good and not the negative of life. But it reflects, and your children see it. But also, the world watches how we interact with our family. Do they see us constantly battle with each other? Better is a dry morsel in quietness therewith than a house full of feastings with strife. Proverbs 17 and verse 1. Fathers have a responsibility to model temperance and patience in the home for its name's sake. Number 2, we're quitting at 10 till, aren't we? 5 till, 15? Five minutes from now? Oh, 5 till. Okay. Well, I just wasted about 45 seconds. Number 2, a preacher should leave his family a home unmolested. Recent studies revealed over 1 million children in 48 states were abused in a 12-month period. State Child Protective Service Agency said in that same time frame there were 3 million cases of alleged maltreatment, including neglect, 53%, physical abuse, 26%, and sex abuse, 14%. Sadly, even in Christian homes and in preachers' homes, there have been fathers who have harmed their children in different ways. Fathers, we should be horrified of leaving our homes with such memories. We must protect our families from the misery of divorce. Why would you say that to preachers? Reflect for a moment. Do you know any preachers who have suffered divorce? Either because of something they did, or their spouse did, or they together couldn't get along? We're not supermen. That's something I've tried to emphasize all along. The things that others struggle with, we are going to wrestle with ourselves. Divorce is a plague on those that are left behind. It hurts them. It has a lasting impact on them. David Moore, in somewhat of a dated book now called Five Lies of the Century, said something like this. He said, the daily result of marital failure is 2,750 broken-hearted children. That's over 1 million every year. I don't know how long the statistic has gone. Of the anecdote of 1 million divorces every year, it used to be we would say 20 years, 30 years. It's over 30 years now. Of over 1 million divorces, and in many of those homes that break apart, there are children. And if a man and his wife divorce after their children leave home, don't think that still doesn't have a huge impact on those adult children who have to endure that. But also we must protect our families from the offense of bad habits. Samuel Johnson said, the chains of habit are too weak to be felt till they are too strong to be broken. Every habit is had at the cost of time and energy and money. Every moment that we spend indulging in it comes at the expense of something else, but we've got to redeem the time. Ephesians 5 and verse 16. Every dollar spent to support that habit is had at the cost of something, but we must first give ourselves to the Lord and to God as we ought to as good stewards. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 5. Every ounce of energy that it is devoted to it comes at the expense of something else, but there's so much to be done for the Lord and so few years of health and strength in which we are to do it. Some habits are neither good nor bad, but they can become bad through excessive participation in them. Some habits are plain old sinful, from tobacco to gambling to pornography. Bad habits leave bad impressions on children who often pick them up from parents. They can destroy a person's character. They can callous a heart, and no Christian would want to leave that for their family. But also, we must protect our families from the influence of worldliness. I believe this is a very subtle enemy that we fight each and every day. You know, I need help in knowing how best to deal with that. I want to raise my children not in a bubble. They've got to go out into the world someday. But I don't want to be so callous in that I expose them unnecessarily to things that are going to hurt them. Boy, that's something I juggle with all the time. As I think about that, we're to do this through certain ways in our homes, through pure speech. Let's be vigilant about that. Proverbs 2 and verse 8, sound speech that cannot be condemned. And he that is of the contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil thing to say to you. Through spiritual affections. If they were to do an anonymous survey of your children about what was most important in your home, saying, this blank is what's most important to my mom and my dad, what would your children say? Set your affections on things above and not on things of the earth. Colossians 3 and verse 2. but also a righteous appetite. What do we yearn for in our home? What is it that drives us? Matthew 5 and verse 6, blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. We are guardians of the sacred truth, love not the world, in our homes. So we're going to teach the truth and guide our homes about those subjects that are often thorny with their peers. Things like immodesty and dancing. And ever increasingly, the need to take a very firm and educated stand on homosexuality. That's going to be one of the biggest struggles we're fighting in the church in a few years. Especially those who want to try to serve and to use the court system to fight their way in to serve in our congregations. Premarital sex. We've got to go to the Bible and be very clear on that as our beacon. We're not going to leave the monitoring men of the television and the music and the computer only to our wives, but we're going to take the lead there. Let's take seriously 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7 that a little leaven leavens the whole lump when it comes to the influence of the world upon our home. But then third, men, we're going to leave our homes with a love undeniable. In child rearing, there must be a balance between firmness and fairness, between toughness and tenderness. Love without law will spoil your children, Proverbs 13:24. Law without love will frustrate them, Colossians 3 and verse 21. Abbott says that a child frequently irritated by over-severity and an injustice to which nevertheless it must submit acquires a spirit of sullen resignation which leads to despair. Love is going to show itself to our children through proper discipline and training. Ephesians 6 and verse 4. Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Understanding the child and pushing that child in the direction that he needs to go based on his temperament and his personality. Discipline is everything from gentle encouragement to spanking in several levels in between. And as they get older, you take away privileges. It's very effective. But as we look at love, we see that love is disciplining, but love's motive and discipline must be clear. That discipline being done not because we're angry and frustrated and reacting, but because we love, is going to lead them in the direction we want them to go. That's why Solomon urged, let your soul not spare for its crying, Proverbs 19 and verse 18. You know, children need to remember your home as a place filled with love. It's a place where you unashamedly showed affection to their mama. You know, if your children are saying, oh, Dad, that's gross, you're doing something right. But also show that kind of affection to them so that they know that they're loved. They should be taught to obey their parents and God, not out of the motivation of have to, but out of the motivation of love. Galatians 5 and verse 13 tells the church that, brethren, you've been called into liberty. Only use not liberty as an occasion of the flesh, but by love serve one another. We've heard some great things this week about what should be the platform and the motivation for our service and our relationship to God. It needs to be love. We need to make sure we're teaching that in our home. Our children also need to learn the lesson. Now, I know that one of you might even be the mother and father of one of our future daughters-in-law. Could happen. Who knows? And if that's the case, I want to say, and I hope we're trying to do the same thing, that with regard to how you're raising your children, make sure they learn that love involves feelings. But love is an action. You know, when you go through the process of counseling, so many people come into the office and they're talking about things that they feel and how come they don't, that why they don't feel in love anymore. They've lost that loving feeling. But you know what? We have to say, you've got to act your way to a better way of feeling. I think we can illustrate it this way. You don't put an infant in the driver's seat and strap the parent in the back, do you? You put the parent in the driver's seat and you make sure that the child is in the safety seat in the back. I think that action and feelings kind of work that way. You've got to have feelings. God made us feeling creatures. But the feelings can't be in the driver's seat of a relationship. It's got to be firmly placed in the back seat, and action is in the driver's seat. 1 Corinthians 13, 4-8, there are 16 individual components to that definition of love. Only two even imply emotion, happiness and anger in verse 5 and 6. But even those are driven by proper actions. Love is an action. If we can teach our boys and girls, our young men and our young women that love is committed to a certain course that's in the best interest of the other person, there's an abundance of good feelings that come out of that. But the feelings can't be in the lead. We should also leave our wives incidentally with the feeling that she is firmly loved without any mistake and knowing that. Because if you think about it, you're going to retire and you're going to leave co-workers or they're going to leave you. You're going to move away from congregations or members of that congregation are going to move away from you. You're going to move away from brethren or they're going to move away from you. You're going to watch your children grow up and eventually leave the home. You're going to leave your father and mother. And if things in time hold true, they're going to leave you before you leave this earth. But your wife will always be by your side. Let's be careful to properly invest with that being the case. And if you do, you're going to continue to provide security and example for your children once they leave the home. You're going to show them what it means to love a spouse and to love God. And finally, the preacher should leave his family a leader, unquestionable. Dr. Fitzhugh Dodson said this. He said, "One parent cannot possibly play both roles. Some aspects of fatherhood are interchangeable with similar aspects of motherhood, but certain phases are unique to the father, and only he can play this part of the parental role. If he fails to fulfill this role, his wife cannot take over and do the job no matter how good a mother that she is." God has structured the home in a certain way, with children in subjection to their parents, with the wife in subjection to her husband, and with the husband in subjection to Christ. Undoubtedly, then, God holds the man most accountable spiritually in the home. Men, we must take the lead in decision-making. We're neither the dictator nor the sole decision-maker in our homes, but neither the wife or the children can be the head of the home. We're not at liberty to reverse the roles that God has given. We're also to take the lead in discipline. Ephesians 6 and verse 4. That means the whole training and education of children, which relates to the cultivation of mind and morals and employs for this purpose now commands and admonitions, now reproof and punishment. Who's told to do the nurturing? Ye fathers. Your children should remember the home as a place where dad's lessons and guidance were present. But also we must take the lead in spiritual training. Children usually spend more time with their mothers growing up than they do with their fathers, but man's role as a spiritual leader is as clear today as it was when the first covenant was established. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, "And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you are sitting in the house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." Who did God speak those words to? To fathers. When you must stand before Christ to give account of your spiritual leadership in your home, can you confidently say that you filled properly your role as husband and father? If not, what then? My father, from an early age, you taught me to be true. But when I wavered on what that was, I could always look to you. You taught me how the Lord comes first, at work, at school, at play. But how much easier that became when you practiced it each day. Dear child, I may not perfectly the narrow path traverse, but when you see me fall, dear child, I pray I will reverse. For failures come, they teach us much, and character is fashioned by what we think and say and do, by each prayer and passion. Dear Father, help me teach my children to walk in holy ways, but let me do that by my living. I have but a fleeting few days. May your lessons, Lord, they come to learn at my feet of clay, instill a faith that will survive till they get to the judgment day. Genesis 18 and verse 19. God said of Abraham, "I know him. He will lead his family and his children after him." That challenges me. What kind of legacy am I leaving in my home? Am I rearing children who are going to love the Lord? What about me? What will happen to my family after me? What will happen to my family after me because of me? I don't want you to feel beat down, but I hope that that will challenge you. The job's not over till it's finished. And let's be faithful to the end in rearing our children to love the Lord.